get clear on the type of lifestyle that you want to have first. Let's see how many people we can offend. I don't know how to even bridge the subject of conspiracy theory and permaculture because...
Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Vine podcast. Today we have Jesse Tack. Welcome, Jesse.
Thanks, Cormac. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Could you just give us a quick introduction, please, Jesse?
Yeah, my name is Jesse Tack. I grew up in Lapeer, Michigan, which is like in the thumb. If anybody knows what Michigan looks like, it kind of looks like a glove. So we're up in the thumb is where I grew up. And I grew up in the 80s and 90s out there and had a normal suburban childhood and loved nature and loved crawling around in trees and running through the farm fields and all that. And discovered permaculture somewhere. I took my PDC in 2011, so I must have discovered permaculture about 5 years or so before that. I became really sort of enamored by it, and then it has gravitationally just kept pulling me in and in and in throughout the rest of my life. And I've done all sorts of different jobs and started businesses related to permaculture and done a lot of permaculture work since, including like farming and stuff like that. So yeah, and now I'm in Ypsilanti, which is near Ann Arbor, so still in Michigan. And excited to see where this conversation goes.
Yeah, looking forward to it. You have the honor now of being the first person to appear twice on the podcast.
Oh!
an honor that can never be taken away from me.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I'll have to make myself a plaque.
I'll send you a t-shirt.
Send me a t-shirt. That'd be great. Well, thanks for having me. I do feel honored.
Right, so 2000, when did you first hear about permaculture? You said it was five or 6 years before 2011.
Yeah, I think it was like, I've occasionally tried to trace where I first heard about it. And I think it was through the book Fast Food Nation. I think that was a book. Did you ever read that? Is that a book?
Is that the book about the guy who eats the fast food for 30 days or something?
Yeah, or it's something else. That. It's the... I'm blanking on it. I think it was Fast Food Nation was maybe the book or something like that. But anyway, there was a book that I read that was really good and just sort of about alternative economics and alternative farming. And then they mentioned in that book, Joel Salatin. And that was just something like, it just seemed so interesting what they're writing about that I was like, oh, who is this guy, you know? And then, so I went down the Joel Salatin rabbit hole. And he's like, if you don't know of him, anybody who's listening, he's sort of like a renegade farmer guy, very kind of a fascinating speaker. The way he describes himself is like a crazy lunatic Christian, you know, regenerative farmer, like this mashup of all these different weird things that you wouldn't think would go together. And he's just one of those guys that you could watch his videos and just get sort of swept into him. He's just a great storyteller. But as I watched his sort of work and saw what his farm was doing, lots of rotational grazing, managing like hundreds of acres, like leasing neighbors' land and managing it in this really sustainable way, building all these great ponds, sustainable woodlots, really high quality meat birds, and you know, any type of meat and eggs and all that. And at some point along there, he mentioned permaculture and that he'd been interested in permaculture since the 70s or something like that. And then I may have heard that word a couple other times, but at some point I was just like, what is this word, you know? And this was sort of like kind of early internet days. So, you know, you start searching around. And I think one of the first things that I found was Bill Mollison's series. What is it? In Grave Danger of Falling Food. And then there's also the Global Gardener series. And both of those were in part on YouTube. And so I was like, as soon as I found Bill Mollison, I was just in, because talk about just a impressive storyteller with lots of wisdom, seemed to me like the way forward. I was like, man, we gotta do permaculture, like through government, permaculture through like how we manage our agriculture. Like, it just seemed so obvious to me. And so I think that's really what hooked me, the Bill Mollison storytelling, some of his history and like what he'd been through in Tasmania and growing up and all of that. And then eventually I got into some of the books, Guy's Garden, Toby Hemingway. That was one of the sort of key books too. And then, eventually I was like, okay, I've been hearing about this permaculture design course. I think I got to take that. And that was in 2011 in Detroit.
And was that a 2 week, 72 hour course?
Yeah, that was the in-person one. Yeah, totally life-changing. And I already kind of knew everything. I'm not trying to be like I knew it all, because I definitely learned a lot, but I kind of knew really what permaculture was. I didn't think it was just gardening or farming. I knew the whole systems approach. But man, just being being there with all those people and having that 72-hour curriculum delivered in that way, totally life-changing, propelled me forward to start many a businesses and just like really sort of reorient my life around that right livelihood concept.
Right. And what kind of businesses did it inspire?
Oh man, many and fledgling ones as well, because gosh, man, I did not know how to start a business, especially back then. And I barely still know how to start a business even to this day, but I know a lot more now than I did then. The first one was like a design firm. I started it with a friend who was in that PDC with me. And we had big visions about like doing large acre restoration projects here in Michigan and really turning Michigan into like a sort of a permaculture exemplar that other people across the world could see and like, you know, connect to and be inspired by. When we were in the PDC in Detroit, the design challenge was how to redesign Detroit, the whole city, which is like 140 acres. It's huge. And that was sort of like a, whoa, like, how do you do something so big? And our teacher, Larry Santoyo, was like, well, really, permaculture applies at all scales. And you don't necessarily start at the big scale, but like you create small, sustainable, replicable models that work in a neighborhood setting. And then you just do that, you duplicate that 1,000 times. And then all of a sudden, you basically have a redesigned permaculture city. And so that was kind of our original idea, that design firm sort of thing. That kind of trickled away on us within about a year. And that was just due to like my friend and I who started that were living sort of separate lives, and he had started to drift off in another direction and I in another direction. So that was a little first stab at it. I worked with a bunch of, maybe not a bunch, but a handful of clients just locally, just saying like, hey, let's do some permaculture. Are you interested? And, you know, I charged a decent amount, but nothing huge, because knowing that I was just sort of like really beginning this work and I didn't know what I could pull off and that sort of thing. And that was good. But the biggest thing that I jumped into probably really upfront was not even a business. It was working as a community leader and educator in Ypsilanti. And so after the design firm kind of trickled away, I started really hosting monthly education events and bringing in speakers on certain topics all related to permaculture, and did that for about 2 years here in Ipsy. And then that led me to access the land. We started working on an 8-acre food forest out of that community work. And then once I was on that land, and we can talk more about that in a second, but then I started more in earnest, like farm scale businesses. So I still run a market garden style, like a very small scale organic vegetable style business called Garden Party. And I have also run sustainable chickens, maybe not sustainable, but rotational chickens. And we did them in alleyways between trees, like the silvo pasture style, inspired, of course, by, you know, laying out permaculture on a broad acre. So that was really fun. We ran 300 birds. And those are kind of the biggest sort of businesses that I had, is really more of a farm homestead business to just make not all of my income, but a sizable portion of my income. And then from there, I went on to do a couple other things, but I'll pause there and see if you want to interject.
No, that's all great. A lot of stuff there. I like the varied nature of it. And as well, how you flowed in from one to another to another. Yeah. So just for listeners, somebody who's just got a PDC, who's just right looking to go out in the world of business, would you have any recommendations of what, like the design ones, an obvious one, but what would your be advice having explored different models just as a beginner to start?
As a beginner, it would be to get clear on the type of lifestyle that you want to have first, and like your personal goals and stuff like that. And holistic management has this framework for like helping get clear on your goals and vision. And I find that to be really like helpful to me. And I think that's critical, because yeah, you could go be a designer. You could also start like a more of a agricultural sort of business based on what you've learned in permaculture. And the cool thing about ag is it's so production oriented, and permaculture teaches us how to use like waste products to turn into more income generation products. So there's sort of no end to like an agricultural or a production-based business. But that's where getting clear on your goals is so critical, because, you know, as I just sort of dabbled in this and that, you know, by the time I got into my agriculture business, I was already in my late 30s or early 40s. And had I been a little more clear about my vision, my intention, the type of lifestyle I wanted, I probably wouldn't have done that, because I would have been like, man, farming is really for a young man's game. Like, it is hard work. You have to grind and you have to have abundant energy, you know? And when you're in your 40s, you know, I don't know about you, but like for me, my energy is less than it was when I was in my mid 20s or something like that. So I would have loved to have started. So I would say if you just got out of a PDC and you're in your mid 20s and you're really interested in that, like on the land, some people call it dirt time, like learning how to get those skills like into your bones, like how to use a broad fork, how to grow food, how to save seed. If that calls to you, I would say start that up, pick a simple product that is already popular. So I picked vegetables because they're already popular. And then from there, you know, spend the next 3 or 4 or 5 years building that business so you can start to hire people. And then by the time you're 40, you're managing that business and you may be able to duplicate it and grow it rather than just running it and being like the physical sort of person behind the whole thing. In terms of design, I think I've been hearing from designers lately, which I think is great advice. And I wish I had it when I was fresh out of the PDC, which is start connecting with other local permaculturists who are designers and seeing if there's a piece of the design puzzle that you could do. Maybe that's like CAD work or like the graphic elements, or maybe you're really, really good at like site design and mapping, but another, you know, your partner in the business, or maybe you're contracting with them at first, maybe they can do the install and the maintenance because you might not have a crew yet or something like that. So I think that's really critical because you can start with all these great ideas, but then, man, do you know how to do the design work? Do you know how to make sure that things are put in properly in terms of the install? And then do you know how to do the maintenance aspect over years? Well, probably not, because you're not really taught that in a PDC. So pick up one of those pieces, get good at it, and see if you can connect to other people who do the other pieces. And then you might be on your way to getting clients coming to you. Maybe you can develop your own crew or your own design firm at that point. I think that's a really good model to sort of consider. And that's true of teaching too. If you want to start teaching, like start on your own, start doing intro courses and like things that you're passionate about, but also see if you can link up with people teaching PDCs and say, hey, can I teach just a piece of the PDC so I can get that skill and I can establish myself? Many, many ways to go. But I think, you know, working smarter, not harder is critical. Your enthusiasm is there now, but like, think about like how you might make it easier on yourself, whichever avenue you happen to take.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. I think it was Mike Hogue's book. They talk about Thistle, about transitioning their permaculture lifestyle and actually thinking about taking it from your lifestyle and holistic approach rather than just diving right on. Like, I know I agree with you. I couldn't do market gardening. The time and the energy. I just don't have it. I have a young family. It's just not happening.
Yep. Yep.
So for me, it's trying to utilize online. That's where I sort of leaned towards. And now this year, I'm looking at going out in the community more and trying to build that side of it. So it's a dual approach.
Yeah.
But it's just what's the time and restrictions I have on just on my timetable. It's just that's what worked out for me. But it is intentional. It's not. It's just that's what I have available, and that's what I could do. So the teaching, but as well, you says you're a community leader. You started running monthly courses. So you touched on it there that you went out. You just started advertising classes and then getting experts in and yourself to run the classes.
Yeah, essentially. We would have a monthly. I was just so excited and I wanted to meet people in my own community. And I still feel the same way. It's like I want permaculture to really be thriving in my county, in my city, in my township, because that's where I live. And I want us to be more resilient. And I want to know people who have all the seeds that I need or the plant material that I might need at some future date, you know? So I was really trying to spin that flywheel of like, let's get this community that I live in really active. And so a lot of it was just intro to permaculture, or let's talk about fungi, because I was super into the mushroom world at that point and its role in ecosystems. Let's talk about rain gardens. So I'd pick like a topic, and usually it would just be on me to sort of organize it. We had a standing location, we're at the same building every month, and it would be at the same time. So it'd be like, I forget exactly what it was, so sometime during the week, you know, like 6 p.m. on this day. And then I would just host it based on my interest. And the cool thing about that was it allowed me to like research deeply into each of those topics and get a little bit more knowledge in preparation for it. And that was great. And I met a lot of wonderful people, and we did a lot of like perma blitzes, as they're called sometimes, you know, like installing bits of a permaculture yard implementation, you know, in a 4-hour period of time with a bunch of people, that sort of thing. We had a bunch of potlucks. We had a bunch of just different connections that were made, including to other experts. And then at some point in there, maybe 6 months in, I started bringing in some of my friends that I already knew and then trying to actually reach out to like experts in a certain topic. Those are a little bit, I didn't do a ton of those because, you know, you typically have to pay the expert and, you know, often they don't live in your town. So it's a little bit like, how are we going to get them here sort of deal. But when it worked out, we did that. Most of all of that work for me was free. And here'd be another piece of advice for anybody doing the community sort of development or community education model that I sort of started with. Try to make it sustainable economically for yourself so that you don't run into a burnout problem. I definitely burnt out. About 2.5 years in, I was like, I can't keep doing these, man. Like, it's free. I had like a tip jar or whatever, so I'd make a little bit of money, but it just wasn't worth it. And it seemed to cut into like quality family time with like my partner and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's not good. That's not sustainable. It's not going to last if you can't make it, you know, like if I was making $50 every time or $100 every time, my partner would have been like, well, cool. This is just part of your income. Like, that's great. Like, go do your thing. But if I was coming home with $10-$15, she's like, well, you've been gone for 3 hours and, you know, like that sort of thing. And it just started to wear. Yeah, it's just too much of a commitment on everybody. And out of my enthusiasm, I think I just ignored that for a while. But eventually it's like, this is just, it's not sustainable. It's not going to last this way. So it's, you know, ironically, that was, I don't know, about 10 years ago. It's only now that I'm rethinking about doing community engagement. And I'm really starting to think with some of my permaculture buddies around here about how to make it sustainable, how to do a subscription model, part education, part installation, something like that, where it is like a functional part of my income stream instead of just something I'm doing out of passion.
Yeah, I think it's important that people think that way as well, because to me, permaculture, they work. Permaculture businesses have to work, and it has to be. Yes. It has to. You have to generate the third principle. One of the, I can't mind it now, create a yield. It's there.
Obtain a yield.
Yep. And the other one is the observe, and you know, you change. So you've done it for 2 years and you're thinking, right, it's not working. So don't be afraid to change. Yep. I need to get a list of them written up.
On the wall behind me. No, I know exactly what you mean, though. Yeah, you need a cheat sheet.
I need a cheat sheet behind me.
But the obtain a yield one is so critical. Like if you're not getting your needs met and you're not getting like something coming back, it just feels like you're giving. And that there's just nowhere to go but burnout if you're just feeling like you're giving. So that's the nice thing about starting a market garden. Yes, you're working your butt off and you're spending all your physical energy, but you do get returns, you know, like you can eat the lettuce and the carrots and that sort of thing. So at least that one was a little bit more like, okay, I've got my yield built in. You know, now the economic returns, that might be a different story, but I agree with you 100%. Don't, if you're starting off, don't do anything without thinking about that obtain a yield piece first.
Yeah. And don't listen to anybody that tells you that's not permaculture.
Exactly.
There's plenty of them. We need to obtain a yield. You need to earn an income. So then the access to the land, the 8 acres, really stepping it up a gear then.
Yeah, so with that permaculture group that I was talking about, we got connected with somebody who was connected to this 64 acre farm called Dawn. Yeah, I may have written it down wrong. Sorry. It's called Dawn Farm, and it's in the township. It's not far at all from my house. And it's, you know, just classic, you know, corn and soybean sort of farmland, 3 different plots of like 8 or 10, 15 acres, something like that. And then the main function of Dawn Farm is they're actually a substance abuse facility. So people who are addicted to drugs and alcohol go there to live. It's a residential facility and they live there to dry out. And it takes about a month or two. So they're there for, you know, kind of a long time out of their life. And so it's just this odd and really interesting community connection that we had. So they wanted, you know, in a way they wanted their land to kick the chemicals because they knew that their land was sort of on that monocrop, lots of herbicide, lots of pesticide model. And so they had this sort of mission of like, we want our clients to kick the chemicals and get, you know, sort of free and organic, but we also want the land to do the same. And that was right around the time that our group was working. And so several of us, maybe about a half a dozen, were really keen on that. We're like, oh, wow, we could do some interesting things on land. And they didn't have much restrictions. They didn't require us to be like, tractor farmers or any of that. They're like, oh, you got an interesting idea about a food forest. Okay, well, let's try it out, you know? And so that's really where I've been ever since. That's been about 10 years now since I've been at Dawn Farm. And we've done all sorts of cool projects. We're running rotational sheep out there, one of our members right now. That's where I ran the chickens that we're talking about. We ordered the trees and organized the effort to put in an 8-acre food forest with about 1,500 mixed tree crops. And now that's in its 8th or 10th year now. So we're really starting to get yields. We're actually getting plums and we're getting chestnuts and hazelnuts finally coming from there. And that's been a huge learning experience. That's where my market garden was. We've done water mitigation strategies because the land where we have the hoop houses on it was quite low and it would flood for about the first 2 months of summer. So over our time there, we've actually dug some like retention basins, like kind of like a half a pond, I would say. It's like a pond for the first couple months of the season and then it dries out. And built ditches, built swales. We've seeded hay seed out there. And really just it's all under the guise of like stewardship. So we're trying to like listen to the land, but also listen to our partners, Dawn Farm. Like, what do they need? What do we need? What does the land need? And then we just try to like do what we can each year on a very voluntary basis. There's nobody paid there. We don't have like a big budget or anything. So new members are welcome to come in. It's $20 to join the co-op. We have a cooperative out there. And that pays for your whole year's dues. And then Dawn Farm pays for our water. I mean, they've been super generous. And because they're a big, well-known entity in the county, they get like resources like wood chips and these types of things. So it's been a really fun partnership. It's a really interesting model. I don't know how replicable it is because it's such a unique like relationship. But, you know, going back to Joel Salatin, I remember him saying way back when, he's like, land access is not really the problem. Like, meet older farmers. They'd be happy to let you work a part of their land if you're willing to put in a little bit of labor to help them when it comes time to harvest the hay or whatever it may be. And I found that to be true myself. Like, there is access to land. What there's not as much of is like, do you know how to manage a bunch of land? Because when we put in that food forest on 8 acres, we did not know how to manage it. Like, how do we manage the weeds? How do we manage the voles? How do we manage the deers? We did not have any of that equipment or infrastructure. So it's been really interesting learning. You know, what's cool about forests is they grow anyway. So even if we weren't managing it, it's still growing. We still got apple trees. We still got 20-foot tall chestnut trees, you know, so it worked out. But yeah, I think that model's really cool. And I don't know, like I said, I don't know if it's replicable, but I think a land stewardship cooperative model is something that people could do, like get together with some friends who are interested in trying out these things, allow people to come and like sort of see it for themselves. And you get new members occasionally who are like, oh, I want to try. And like, we had a lady this year, like, I want to try growing turmeric, you know, like, can we grow turmeric out here? And I was like, I think so. Why don't you try it? We have a hoop house. So she's in the hoop house and she's grown turmeric this year. So it's just kind of an experimental relationship. And we get to just get that. And I said it before, dirt time. We get to learn how to do these things that I don't know about you, Cormac, but I didn't grow up in a farming family. We didn't have any of those manual skills like built in to our family. So we're kind of getting them in this generation.
Yeah, no. But, and it's funny, when I started growing food, everybody kept saying to me, oh, my parents grew food or my granny grew food like one or two generations back. Oh, we had pigs in our backyard and we had chicken. Everybody had it. And then it's like, no, it's gone. As people got more sophisticated and more well off, they like that's the first thing they get rid of, which to me is bizarre when you think about it, that you know, your food and your nutrition is the first thing you outsourced.
Yeah, what?
Wealthy. So to me, it's like this bizarre thing that to me, it seems crazy that they had all these skills and then one day they just goes, I'll go to the supermarket now.
Yeah, the lure of convenience.
And within one generation, it was gone.
Yep, it's truly remarkable. Same thing with my family. It's like, oh yeah, my grandma used to do blah, blah, blah. It's like, people just think you're like a throwback, you know? It's like, oh, you just want to live like they lived like two generations ago. And you're sort of like, well, not exactly, but like kind of.
And then if you, start the permaculture, you start the real reasons why, they just switch off. Oh, here he goes again.
yeah, exactly. Never mind.
No, it's getting dirt time. Something I'm trying to be more purposeful about coming out the following year, because it's all well and good me working in my own garden. Like I just got my spuds there and they're lovely and it's nice and sort of gives you that inspiration again. The sort of end of year harvest I'm getting, it's like, right, I need to start expanding this out and get more dirt time somewhere else. And I'd say just get away from my wee urban plot.
Yeah, but that's a great way to start, I think, because you do feel it's like you can get success pretty easily on a small scale, and then you're like, cool, I can maybe do double this size next time or whatever.
Yeah, and just hoping to get more local work, local designs, dirt time, community work, whatever I can do to get that dirt time. Something I've learned from doing these podcasts is the most advice is people is get out and get your hands dirty and document. And document what you're doing.
That's a good one. I wish I would have documented more, actually.
Yeah, I've heard that a few times as well from people who've done big projects, and even just taking photographs, they're that busy. And getting into that mindset of just getting things done, it's like a few photographs would make a huge difference, because you could talk, you can even talk over them and show the photographs.
Totally. Yep.
And then you have
you can learn so much from documenting too, which I didn't do enough of. You know, if you go back and look at something, you get to go, oh yeah, I shouldn't have done this, you know, instead, or next time I'll do this. So yeah.
And you've probably
advice on that.
And you've forgotten stuff that you learned.
100%. So many times, it's crazy.
So your chicken, you had 300 chickens running on that. So take it, they just let you access the land, and then you got the meat birds to take it. Was it meat birds?
It was meat birds. Yep. Did that with a partner, a friend of mine. We built the Salatin style chicken coops or mobile chicken pens that fit like 75 birds per. We raised up the little chicks inside of structure with, you know, you got to sort of like make sure their heat is perfect and all that sort of stuff. And and then we ran them on in between like chestnut, hazelnut, apple, plum rows of trees. So when we set out the food forest, we did it in what's called a restoration agriculture model, which is based on Mark Shepard's work and that book by the same title. And it's very much like follow the contours of the water, and then you lay out, you know, your tree rows with everything really planted closely. And then you just let whatever nature wants to win, win. And he calls it the stun method. I don't know if you've heard of that, but
yeah, it's sheer
sheer total utter neglect. And his wife actually said, I took a class with him at some point. She was like, actually, it's strategic total utter neglect, because there are times when he would go out and take down the weeds, or he would mulch or something like that. So we sort of were modeling that stun method. We bought a bunch of really cheap, you know, 1-year-old whips that are like 2 feet tall, and we just planted them super close every 2-3 feet, and we kind of mixed them all together, and we just said, have at it, nature. Like, what are you going to keep around? What are you going to favor? What's going to die? Doesn't matter to us. We're just going to see where we're at in 10 years or something, right? And so those are about 50 feet apart. So we have a 50-foot alleyway with like just hay was what was in it. And then that's where we're now running sheep, is in between those alleyways. And that's where we did chickens last year, or I think that was 2 years ago that I did chickens. And we put the tractors like staggered all in the same 50-foot row or alleyway. And then they'd just be like, one would be slightly in front of the other, but offset. And then we just move them once a day. So just get out there and like first thing in the morning, move the chickens. They'll have totally decimated the grass for the day before and done all their littering on it and really improved the land with their, you know, with their scat and all their scratching and everything that chickens do. And yeah, move them once a day, feed them once a day. And that was pretty much it. Making sure that they had water was kind of the most important thing, especially as it got to be summer. And man, those birds, they just grow like crazy. They just get so big and they eat exponentially more and more and more. And I think it took about 7 weeks, maybe 6 weeks, and then it was off to slaughter. And it was all kind of new to us. Like, we just wanted to try it because we wanted meat birds for our own homes. So we knew we were going to each take 25. But we also wanted to see what the market was like. And so we started to sell them by part and by whole through various farmers markets. And It did okay. I would say we basically broke even. It wasn't like some big profit margin, but we could both see how it could make profit if we ramped it up a bit more and bought all the feed wholesale, which we didn't do. We were sort of just buying it as we went. Very shoestring operation, but yeah, learned a lot about it. I definitely know how I would do it next time. And I think the key with that is to start small and then build your chicken market. Because while there may be a million people in your area that eat chicken and want organic, you have to connect with them and you have to somehow convince them to buy your birds as opposed to someone else's or the supermarket birds. But I think if you gave yourself a 3-year window of like start with 100, next year maybe see what the market was, then double it or triple it. And then the third year you can really go into, okay, let's make this like a big chunk of my income. Let's run 2,000 birds or something like that. Because the work's not much. I mean, you're out in the field, it's hot, you got to make sure they have water and feed, but it only takes a half hour a day. I mean, really. And if you had 10 chicken tractors, you know, it'd probably only take you an hour a day. Now, that's not to mitigate the time spent raising the birds from chicks and also what goes into butchering them and storing them. That's a lot of work. But if you did the first year of 100 or 75 birds, and you really were committed to growing it over time, you'd learn all that stuff in the first year. And then you could just say, oh, okay, this is how much time I need to incorporate. These are the, you know, the kill cones and the way I'm going to butcher them. I got that all figured out. And then you just replicate. For us, it was more about learning how to do it and then getting birds for our own freezers.
Yeah. So it's a good idea for a small enterprise for someone starting. And I got a good idea. You can start it on your own. So,
yep, especially if you have some land out there, it's like easy peasy to just throw on some land.
Yeah. All right. So how did you get involved then with Pina?
Yeah. So Pina just last year, actually, I just saw they posted like, hey, we're hiring, you know, and I was sort of, part of the thing that changed me forever with permaculture is having multiple functions for essential or multiple like income streams for really essential, like we need to make X amount of money as a family. I don't want to just have one job just in case I get fired or the job goes under or the economy tanks or something. I want to have multiple income streams. That was something that permaculture really instilled in me. And since 2011, I really have had at least two income streams making up our income, if not more. And so because of that, I sort of don't have full-time work and I really never have. I've done a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And I was working at a hospital in therapy, actually. So I do music therapy and work with people with depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, that sort of thing. And I love that work. It's been really great. But I don't want to be full-time there. And I wasn't full-time there. I don't want to be at the hospital every day. I don't want to have to, like, you know, dress up like the business guy every day. I want to also have land-based business or design or education-based business, too. So I was still working part-time at the hospital when I saw this Pina possibility come up. And then I read through what it was that they're looking for. And they're looking for somebody much like you, Cormac, to like run interviews and conduct like webinars and sort of in a way be a front face, like, hey, we're going to put you out there and you're going to just help build our media presence and our marketing presence and all that. And so as I looked at the application, I was like, gosh, you know, I know a lot of these things. The previous maybe 3 or 4 years, I'd really been studying marketing and I'd really been studying like how to have an online business successfully and to make money online and all that. And that really served me well because Pina was kind of looking for those things. They needed somebody who knew how to do website stuff. They needed a way to grow their SEO on their website. They needed, you know, marketing basically, as well as other pieces. So anyhow, long story short, I applied for that and went through the process and ended up getting the job. There were three hires that happened at that time. Me and I'm sort of like the programs manager. I help run the diploma program and I help run, we're going to have a virtual summit in February. I help run that. I help run the design contest, all sorts of really fun projects. It's just like so cool that this is my job. And then we have two other people who got hired. One was more of a membership manager. Her name's Rebecca. And then Sean, who we talked with you earlier, Cormac, he's communications. So he does social media and stuff like that. So that's kind of how I got hooked up with Pina. And it's just really, it's because I kept, you know, you could call it luck, but it's like I kept myself prepared for options is how I sort of think about it. And always learning and always adding to my toolkit of like things that I can bring to the table. Had I not studied marketing, kind of on a lark. You know, my wife's like, what are you studying all this internet stuff for? You know, and it's like, I don't know. I just feel like I need to know it. Finally, I'm like 10 years too late. But had I not done that, I wouldn't have really qualified for that job and I would have probably never got it. And to date, it's been great. I've been working there since May and it's really been a wonderful job. Lots of cool opportunities come up because I'm working. It's kind of like an institutional permaculture job, which can sound icky to me. You know, it's like, I don't want to be an institution. But on the other hand, the cool things about that is you get more resources. You get access maybe to more people that you wouldn't have had access to because you're just some guy doing your own thing versus, you're part of an institution, you know, that we recognize that institution, that sort of thing. So yeah, man, it's been great. I could talk about PINA forever. I really have enjoyed it. And that just stands for the Permaculture Institute of North America. Anybody listening? So that's our purview, is really thinking about the North American permaculture movement.
Yeah, I must say I was surprised that you yourself and Sean aren't the typical institution sort of type person.
Yes, totally.
That's like, right.
No, I don't know Sean that well, but he's like very much like me. He's kind of like, I don't know if the word anarchist means what I'm trying to say, but sort of like do it yourself. Like, I don't need like an institutional job. I don't need a paycheck. I'll sell seeds or I'll like do a little bit of this, a little bit of that. That's both Sean and I. So
maybe that's
their hooks in us.
Maybe that's the new institutional person.
Maybe. That's a good point.
Yeah. The new breed.
The new breed. Yeah. It certainly is for me. And I'm part-time with PINA too. It's the same thing. It's like, I don't really want a full-time, like I'm fully committed to this one thing. I want to be able to have optionality and like income coming from multiple places. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's good. I was very surprised there. So post PDC, you mentioned there PINA and post PDC options.
Yeah. Like you mentioned earlier, like, so if someone just got out of a PDC, like what would you advise about starting a business? Well, one of those answers that I didn't mention would be to consider looking into PINA. We have a diploma program, which had I known about out of my PDC, or maybe it wasn't even fully developed at that point, 2011, but that would have been a really great pathway to walk because, you know, I don't know how you feel about like mentorship or working with a mentor, even if you have to pay money, can like just save you so many dividends and solve so many issues that might have been a stumbling block for you. And like a mentor or some like a little bit of assistance can just like clear that path for you and make it just so much smoother and so much more successful. And I think if I was fresh out of a PDC, I was like, dude, I got to make permaculture a part of my life, or I want to start a permaculture business for sure. Then please look into the diploma program. There's 6 diplomas. They all are different specialties. Like, do you want to do design? Do you want to do education, et cetera? But find the one that's right for you and consider applying and working with PINA, because we not only offer mentorship, like a field advisor who helps you craft a plan, but the cool thing about it, it's like a trades college. You know, it's like you go for 2 years and you become a plumber, or you go for 2 years and you become a builder or something. And it's the same thing for permaculture. It's guidance. It's sort of like step-by-step, like here's ways that you can do it. But it's also very, I used the word anarchy before, so I'll use it again. It's kind of anarchist. It's like, it's up to you to design your step-by-step process, and then PINA and your field advisor will support you. So it's not rigid. It's not like you must do this. You have to meet certain benchmarks, but you really get to do it how it works for you and what makes most sense for your lifestyle. And what I love about it too is like, man, you can start making money with permaculture within 6 months or even less while you're earning your diploma. So by the time you get done 2 years with your diploma, you'll have made, you know, X amount of money and be well on your way to a really stable career in permaculture. Plus you get all these connections that PINA has that you don't necessarily have if you're on your own. So if you're working with a field advisor and you're in some random part of the world, hopefully they're going to be like, cool, you got to know so-and-so, let me hook you up with such and such. They'll be a real good partnership for you. So that's something I would just encourage everybody. If you're post CDs, PDC, and you're really excited, check it out. It's on the PINA website under diploma. Good information, good free like downloads that you can get and read just to learn all about it.
Yeah, I have actually enrolled in since chatting to you and Sean last, on the UK permaculture diploma. So nice. Basically my reason, well, I was after chatting these and I sort of, I'd been toying with it for a while, but for me, it's about how do I develop myself as a designer and explore all these different ways. So I might think, as you say, go down a path and it'd be the wrong path, needing that mentorship and that guidance they become a better permaculture practitioner and they get that balance as a learner going forward. If you have someone who's experienced looking back, they can guide you. And overall, for the, I think yours is quite reasonable as well. Your membership, it's not a fortune.
Right.
For that money, it's well worth the value to have that mentorship. So I would definitely recommend for those in North America, they do it. It makes sense. And they get part of that community. The competition, how's that going? Your design competition?
Oh, man, it's going good. Yeah, the permaculture design competition is so fun to be a part of. We've not got a ton of submissions, but I hear it's kind of like signing up for like anything. Like a lot of the signups and a lot of the submissions come sort of toward the last end, or the last week of the period, right? So it's running right now from September to October 1st. All people can submit. There's a $5,000 grant prize for, you know, PINA members vote on the best prize based on permaculture ethics and good design and all that. And yeah, you could earn $5,000 to install a part of a project or, you know, sort of like take a project to the next level. There's also a brand new designer. So if you have taken your PDC within the past 3 years, you have a separate design that you can win for $1,000 to put toward whatever project that you have in mind. And then there's all sorts of like, again, part of being part of an institution that's cool is you get all these like freebies. So we've gotten all these permaculture authors to offer up like free books for honorable mentions. And there's just a bunch of great books. You can check it out on the website. And then there's the natural, I think it's called Natural Capital Plant Database, which is a fantastic database. If people aren't familiar with it, it's just got all the permaculture plants within it, basically. And there's a free version of that, but the anybody who enters, period, end of story, doesn't matter if you win or lose or whatever, if you enter, you get a free premium membership, which is a $50 value to the Natural Capital Plant Database, which is just super cool too. I wish I could enter just for that, but I can't because I'm part of PINA.
You'll be creating a second identity.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Fraud my program here.
And then, the virtual summit. How can you get involved in that?
I don't think. Here's the story. And then the short answer is you can just email me. I'm at programs@pina.in. So programs@pina.in. If you're interested in the summit, so it's a virtual summit. It's February 2nd and 4th, and it's going to be about starting permaculture business. That's really where PINA is trying to help its members, but also that's where our members have fed back to us. Like we just want resources to like, again, if I'm fresh out of a PDC and I want to start a for-profit business or I want to start a nonprofit business, like, are there models that I can replicate? Is there people who've done it before and they can like help me with the learning curve, help me sort of like move quicker through the process than you might do if you're just on your own figuring it out. So it's really going to be focused on that. There's two tracks. One is permaculture business, and it'll include, you know, like I said, for-profit, nonprofit, and cooperatives. And then the other track is fire mitigation. And we pinned that one down because PINA has already done fire mitigation work with biochar and controlled burning. We have a program on that already. But B, the fires in Lahaina and the fires everywhere. Like fire was just like big time this year. So we're like, well, let's make it topical. Let's talk about, you know, permaculture strategies for fire mitigation at different strata and different scales. So yeah, the summit's going to be great. We're just now reaching out to people for like, hey, who do you know who's really good at setting up permaculture nonprofits? Or who do you know that's a great example of a design firm? That sort of thing. So if anybody listening to this like feels like they themselves are that, or they know somebody, email me and I'll send you a form, or maybe I can even send it to you, Cormac. You can put it in the show notes. It's just like a Google form that people can fill out.
Yeah, I'm going to put that in the notes, no bar. And I think come January, February, we'll get you back on for the live stream probably to chat about that.
That'd be great.
I'll be interested in that myself.
Yeah, me too. And that goes to marketing. Like, I've never done a summit. So I hear they're good marketing tools, but I don't know, right? So it's like, we'll figure it out. We'll be learning a lot as we run this first summit of ours, or first summit of mine. PINA has done one summit before.
Right. Personally, what I find my summits is it's very hard, especially like you mentioned there, you have three or four sources of income. And for someone who's practicing permaculture, they sit down for 3 days.
Exactly. It's like, nah, not gonna happen.
I find I get maybe an hour a day. And, yeah. And then you spend a month trying to go back through the stuff.
Yes, I'm totally with you there. Yeah, I'm totally with you there. I'm almost more at this point, like, I'll buy it all and then I'll just listen to the one or two that I really wanted. Oh, I gotta watch that one. I gotta hear about that one. That's kind of how I do it nowadays. But you know, maybe younger folks would have a little bit more time, and they just be like, "Oh, I'm all in. I'm gonna watch the whole thing."
Yeah, I mean, the one summer I did watch one summer. It was good when you get into it, and then I had the time. Just at the time, I had the 2 days to sit and watch it. I think I done one summer once a couple of years, 3 years ago maybe. But normally I just dip in and out. But that's the beauty of you can get access to the summits. He says, yeah, you can buy it and watch it later.
That's right. Yeah, totally.
And now on to the bit that I've been looking forward to when I seen your application form, permaculture and conspiracy theories.
Oh, man, yeah. Oh, let's see how many people we can offend. No, I'm just kidding. Well, so this is something that's just on my mind, and it's like, I don't know how to even bridge the subject of conspiracy theory and permaculture, because, you know, both of those topics are sort of fringe a little bit. Permaculture is still fringe, it's still subcultural, and it kind of always has been, right? It's sort of on the margins of popular agriculture and the margins of popular discussions about economic systems and that sort of thing. So it's a little bit already over in that realm. But what I really find fascinating nowadays is like our inability to sense make the world. It's just really, really hard to make sense of data, what is true, what is not true. It's, I don't know for you, Cormac, where you're at, but for me over the past 10 years or so, it's even gotten worse. It's like, oh, if you didn't vote for Trump, I won't even talk to you. You know, or it's like, oh, if you think that fill in the blank topic is true, then you're a total idiot. It's like so divisive and divided. And I really want like permaculture, especially because that's like my baby. That's what I love. That's the area that I like to really sort of spend time in, because it's practical, because it's giving back to Earth, and because it gives us a whole new way to live that I think ultimately could be the way to live on Earth, like sustainably and healthily. But I do believe that there are areas that are directly related to permaculture that are off of the table for general conversation because they are labeled conspiratorial or conspiracy theory. And that's where I just like, I'm not claiming that I know anything better than anybody else. What I'm claiming is I want us to not be turned off by things that are labeled conspiracy theory immediately. And what I'm really asking is, let's all get together and let's start to like actually weigh evidence about things, particularly that are really important. Like global warming is the obvious one, right? Because that is something that galvanizes a lot of permaculturists, and that's really important. It's something that we think about, we design about. But there's a lot of, I don't know how much you listen to quote unquote conspiracy theorists, but there's a lot of alternative points of view on global warming, some of which I'm sure are like, you know, dismissible, but others I am not so sure that they're dismissible. And I'm worried that if we are just turned off by anything labeled conspiracy theory, that we're going to be missing important pieces of data. And I could talk more about that. But the last thing I'll say is just to sort of, in this like really funny meta way, the term conspiracy theorist is a CIA term created by the CIA. And it was related to the JFK assassination when people started to go like, hey, that seemed like an inside job type deal. Like, I don't know about that magic bullet theory necessarily. Like, there seems to be more going on there, right? And of course, in America, this was a time of like all sorts of political leaders and like thought leaders being assassinated. And I do believe there was probably some like conspiracies involved in that. Like, I don't know who, and I don't think any of us should claim to know, because the whole point of conspiracies is that it might be hidden. People are doing things in an agenda sort of way. But so I just want to point that out. Like, it was actually, the term itself was used to divide us and to tell people not to look at X, Y, or Z because you're just a quote unquote conspiracy theorist. And to me, that's problematic. Now, on the other hand, I look at a lot of conspiracy theorists and I think, man, these people just, they don't qualify what they're saying at all. They say categorically, this is how it is. And if you don't believe me, you're a total idiot. And that's not the way either. So there's like these two divisions. There's some people who will not look at anything labeled conspiracy because, oh, that's cuckoo, you're lost your mind. And then there's other people who are kind of have lost their mind or are so like inapproachable in their information and the way that they communicate that, you know, if you have an alternative point of view, you're just an idiot, as opposed to, oh, okay, well, let's mash our data sets together and see if actually we can make sense of this world, instead of just like thinking we're right and thinking the other person's wrong all the time. So that's kind of where I'm coming. I could go deep. We could talk about this, as we said earlier, forever.
I think we'll probably have a random podcast about that separately. I think that'd be great. But for me growing up, I grew up in a divided society. Northern Ireland, there's Protestants. Wow. Protestants want a stay in the Union, and nationalists, Catholics, want to join a United Ireland. Very few exceptions to that. So I understand the polarization, that basically there is no, and they make it more complicated, the Catholic or socialists, whereas the Protestants would be more conservative leaning, left and right. So you have all these things that go on, and yes, it is polarized. And I've seen that America's just catching up. And it is crazy. And then the labeling of people the conspiracy theory label is just something to tarnish someone. I'm not arguing with you. I'm just calling you a conspiracy theorist. So already it's a term used to shut someone down. It's just like, you're just a conspiracy because you don't, I don't want, it's just like someone doesn't want to listen to what you're saying.
Right.
Just like, I think the recent news, like Russell Brand's all over the place, there's conspiracy theories popping up on both sides. And the truth, yep, the truth is everywhere and nowhere. So to me, it's fascinating just to find it. A lot of times I just switch off and go out to the garden and forget about it.
Me too. That's kind of what you have to do. Get grounded.
Yeah. And that's what you know, to get involved in these big, like the JFK, like what's the point of me sitting here worrying about the JFK assassination or the climate change? I think the problem with the climate change conspiracy theorists is the climate change narrative and the politics that comes behind that. Like, we have ULEZ here in London, and it's like, right, we're going to charge you £15 if you go through these areas. So you're allowed to break the pollution rules as long as you give me £15. Well, that's nothing to do with the environment. Yes. That's taxes. Yeah. That's raising money. So don't say I'm doing this for the climate. You're doing it to tax me. No, that's not here. That's in London. They're trying it, but they keep cutting the cameras down. So
yeah, I've been seeing some of that.
And then when you as a government tell me, we're going to tax you because of the environment, and then hand out a fracking license, it's like, well, excuse me, like, come on. You're now, am I a conspiracy theorist for saying that?
Right. Well, for certainly some people would label you that, right? But like us permaculturists, it's like we have to be so skeptical and watch out for greenwashing in general. Like, oh, they call that organic chicken, but only because it has a 1 foot area of dirt that it can walk on for a half hour a day. It's like we're used to greenwashing. So it's hard to parse it out. But I think that's our job here, especially as, because we're not buying, I don't think most permaculture buy the idea of like, oh, we'll just carbon credit tax our way to a healthy green economy. Like, no, it's not going to work that way. And like you said, somebody's benefiting from that. It's like somebody's just making money on that. And if it's the government, you know, no matter where you stand, I don't think they're like all about having an ecological permacultural society. You know, that's just my opinion on that. But yeah, so, you know, the climate change narrative, it has been turned into, at first, I remember it was turned into CO2 was the primary cause, right? And then doing my studies, I read about Walter Jenny. I don't know if you ever checked him out. He was an Australian guy. But he and his research were very much saying, well, CO2 is a very minor piece to the climate puzzle. Water vapor, it turns out to be, is a much more high predictor of weather and weather patterns, like 90% more predictive than CO2. So like there's that piece to it. And then there's just all these layers. And I guess my call is like, I would love permaculturists to get together at, be damned the labels, and actually look at the best data from all sides. So I don't care if you're a wacko conspiracy theorist, give us your best data And then all the rest of us give us our best data and like get a panel together or multiple panels or congresses and try to parse it. Try to get to a place where we can at least weight data so we can kind of make sense of this picture that has been muddied by the conspiracy theory label, but also agendas and politicians and other agendas like the WEF. And, you know, there's agendas all around, and it really makes sense making part of the world. But I fear that we might get caught up in some type of greenwashing narrative and then be divided as a permaculture movement. And so I'd rather avoid that if we could.
Yeah, to me as well, the permaculture is a decentralized solution. So it involves a decentralization, and governments don't like decentralization. They like centralization. So to me, you have to just go out and build these communities yourself. So you're building alternative communities, but within the government structures. So yep. you have to go both worlds, because the government isn't going to come and help you and suddenly say, oh, here's your cities. Now you're going to, we're going to, like, I wouldn't trust the government to come in and create a permaculture city. I think has to be built by the people up. And
right.
For me, getting together with people and talking to them, I would just go, I'm just going to go and do.
Yep.
So you can have your conspiracy theories, but we need to build this world. And if we just start in your garden, start in your street, start in your community, and move up to your city, and to me, the only way we can do this permaculture is just by doing it and talking and putting them stupid things that, if you're left, you hear, like, have you seen that documentary about the feedback loops? Basically, that if I watch left-leaning content, I'm fed left-leaning content. And then everything I see is left-leaning, and I meet you and you're right-leaning. And I can't understand how after all this information that you're even considering, how do you even hold that position? Because I've just been failed that, because that's what the social media is feeding me. And you're coming from the same. And then they basically, the documentary says that that's how the polarization happens, because you're just fed stuff because they want to get clicks.
Yep, that's right. And that goes to my sense making. That's exactly what I'm getting at. It's like, how do we make sense if everybody has a different, slightly different reality tunnel through their algorithms? Then, man, making sense is hard. But like you say, and this is why I love permaculture, it's like, ultimately the truth's in the pudding. It's like, get out there and build a garden, you know, get out there and do something practical in the world. At the very least, that's our best sort of like most immediate leverage point. I do think that we do need to get together and try to make sense of and parse out what's a narrative versus what is true, so we can maybe have some like unification. But ultimately, it does come down to, hey, don't go, if you're one of those people who's way down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theory and it's ruining your quality of life, your relationships aren't going well, you're not building a garden because you're just into some rabbit hole of conspiracy theory, then it's not serving you. So it's like, have your thoughts, have your beliefs, but also get out there and just do what you know is right. Build a garden, make a pond, you know, work with your neighbors. Because like you said, we got to build those parallel systems no matter what. It would be wonderful if we could make sense of the world together, but that's almost a secondary thing. That's my whole conspiracy rant. Don't get caught into just being a conspiracy theorist, and please don't get caught into just dismissing anything that even remotely sounds like conspiracy, because odds are somewhere in the middle there is sort of the truth.
Yeah, the truth is everywhere and nowhere.
I love that. Yeah, I don't know if that's your statement, but I love that.
Jesse, that's been up. It's been really nice to have you on. Nice to chat. I could chat about that stuff for ages.
Me too. Thanks for being open to it.
Yeah, well, we're open to anything here. As long as the guest brings it up, we're not pushing our. We have no agenda to push apart from go out and grow your own food. And start your own business. Yep. If you can, I like yourself. Multiple streams of income is important. Don't rely on any one thing. I'm like yourself. I work part-time as well in a hospital. I'm an engineer. And then I'm trying to build all streams of income as well through design work and through the podcast and things like that. So permacultures seem to be like that. They're all very busy.
Yeah, makes it a life really like always exciting and always possibilities. It never is boring. And I owe a lot of that to permaculture.
And we get to meet a lot of great people, whether they're conspiracy theorists or not.
Yeah, that's right.
Jesse, thanks very much. It's been great. I'll leave all your links down in the descriptions. And again, I forgot to ask everybody to subscribe to the channel. I always forget that.
Come on, people, subscribe.
I don't know, because like our views and our subscribers don't really make sense.
Yes.
That's just figuring out the YouTube. Jesse.
Well, talk about the algorithm, right? Like you got, if you subscribe, then you get better algorithm results and all that. So yeah.
Apparently you can't ask for likes, comments, and subscribes together. You have to, but I get that caught up chatting to people. I forget to do it.
Oh, right. Yeah. Me too.
I'll have to stick it in afterwards, but then Jesse, thanks very much. It's been great. And I'll chat to you soon.
Thanks, Cormac. This has been awesome. Yep. We'll talk soon.